HYY.
This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoane. The show received an email recently complaining about my, quote, excessive use of the words as well. Encourage her, the writer said, to use it less often or substitute the words to or also. He added that those who use the word irregardless are ignorant. Our guest, Ammon Shay, includes that word in his new book, Bad English, A History of Linguistic Aggravation, in his chapter, Words That Are Not Words. He delves into what he calls the glorious mess of the English language that, or is it which, alters and embraces rejected and made-up words. Ammon Shay's previous book is Reading the OED, One Man, One Year, 21,730 pages, and he joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. And Ammon Shay, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Nice to have you here. Let's get right down into this word, irregardless. You write, it is admittedly difficult to offer much by the way of defense to the word irregardless.
Yes, it is one of those words that people really love to hate. And I'm not trying to defend it, but I do find it odd when people say that it is not a word. It is certainly a word because people speak it, they write it. It is perhaps not a word that most people like very much, but that doesn't take away from its wordhood, so to speak. It's also a little bit older than people typically think. It's been around at least since 1795. The first case I've seen of it was in a really kind of terrible poem in the Charleston City Gazette, which with the line, "But death, irregardless of tenderest ties, resolved the good Betty at length to bereave." And it's bounced around the English language since the end of the 18th century, and it seems to be coming up a little more frequently now.
Why not say just regardless?
Well, it's not the only word in English which has had a meaningless prefix attached to it. For instance, we have valuable and invaluable, which are very, very similar. We have habitable and inhabitable, which are also more or less synonymous. And we also used to have personate and impersonate. Personate is less often used, but those two words did exist at the same time. So I think it's really a verbal tick that caught on. I mean, there is no need to have that superfluous IR at the beginning, except perhaps to annoy people.
Is there something unique about the English language that makes it so messy to use your words?
I don't know. There is actually, and it's that it's vibrant, it's alive, and I think it's something that is frequently overlooked when people complain about language and the fact that language is changing. Is that healthy languages change and dead or dying languages do not change? You notice that it is very infrequent that people complain about the changing slang in Latin.
Right,
or ancient
Gallia
Greek.
Est divisa, right?
right. It's a dead language. Nobody's speaking it, so we needn't worry about such things. But one of the clearest hallmarks of a living language is that it is constantly changing. And so that's a sign of health, is that English is spread like this kind of enormously malignant tumor. I mean, it's everywhere in the world. It's going across all the continents. It's picked up by billions of people. And one of the ways that is we see evidence of that is that the language shifts.
You are clearly not a member of the language police. I mean, you embrace all these sort of idiosyncrasies of the English language. But are there things that when you hear them, or words when you hear them, you get that thing up your spine that just almost hurts your ears?
The thing that hurts my ears is when I hear people say, "That's not a word." I find that saying something is not a word, it's a little bit, I liken it to saying that the car that's about to run you over is not a car. You can't make something not exist simply by dint of not liking it. These are words. It's a lot different to say that's not a word that I approve of. For instance, you hear people say impact is not a verb, a very common one. Of course, impact is a verb. People use it as a verb. That is all you need to make it a word. And what's interesting about impact, for instance, is that people like to say, well, impact was a noun, so, you know, why don't we just leave well enough alone? That argument would have a lot more weight to it were it not for the fact that impact is actually was a verb for about 200 years before it ever began to be used as a noun. Impact has worked as a verb in English since about 1601. It wasn't used as a noun until the 19th century. But even if the order was reversed, or were reversed there, it still is a verb simply by virtue of the fact that people use it as one.
And that's your definition. Other, I guess, nouns that became verbs, author, bus, chair, debut, feature. I mean, these are all taken from your book.
Sure.
These are all, you know, you bus a table.
Right.
You chair a meeting.
Sure. And, you know, I mean, people like to say friend. Friend has been used as a verb for 800 years. Gift has been used as a verb for at least 400 years.
How about re-gift? That's re-gift, a new one, right?
I think it's a little more recent. but again, it's not solely the fact that a word has been around for a long time that gives it, you know, acceptability. Mm-hmm. But it does illustrate that these are not necessarily creations of 20th century teenagers.
We have a vice president who loves to use the word literally. And I don't know whether if people, I noticed it a couple of years ago, and literally is in your book. And I think it's just his way of sort of underscoring whatever it is that he's saying. You know, I thought I would die. I literally thought I would die. Mm-hmm. Where does literally come from?
The earliest meaning of literal was relating to letters. It referred to an actual kind of transcription, letter for letter transcription of something. And from that, it broadened slightly to mean, you know, more or less the way that the purists, you know, think of it, which is in an exact manner. It started to broaden some more in the 18th century, maybe early 19th century, when people started to use it more or less as an intensifier, meaning very, or in some cases, meaning figuratively. It has been annoying people ever since, and it continues to do a fine job of that. That being said, there are dozens, if not hundreds, of really fine writers, people who we would not really think of scolding for their language use, who have used it in this extremely non-literal fashion. Mark Twain uses it in Tom Sawyer, that great scene where Tom has bamboozled the neighborhood boys into giving him all kinds of gifts for the honor of whitewashing his fence, and he has a line at the end of it, you know, Tom was literally swimming in wealth. Yeah. There's no indication that he's, rolling in wealth, but there's no indication he's actually rolling around on the ground. Nabokov uses it in Invitation to a Beheading, and with his eyes, he literally scoured the corners of his cell. I think that we understand what he's saying, and again, we may not care for it, but it is in fairly widespread use.
You also write about words that were sort of made up, scofflaw being one of them. I mean, that was a contest.
Yeah, that's an odd one. You know, one of the things that people, the conceptions that people have about language that I think is somewhat misguided is this notion that you can make a word up and if it's a good word, it'll stick. If there's a need for this word, it almost never happens. Uh-huh. But once in a while, it does. And the word scofflaw came up in 1924 when a man named Delsevier King had this idea that we needed a word for people who were not observing the 18th Amendment, the Prohibition Amendment. And so we had a contest, and thousands of entries sent in, and two people sent in the suggestion of scofflaw. And it stuck, which is very, very rare.
Yeah.
But what's interesting about scofflaw is that nobody uses it in the original meaning. It immediately changed its semantic content, and it's, you know, when was the last time you needed to refer to somebody who failed to observe the 18th Amendment? I mean, it's just
exactly
right aside of historically, there's no need for that.
Well, I have a word I would love to get people to use, insinuendo, which would be innuendo and insinuation. I think that would be I've been working on this for a while. I've obviously completely failed.
Maybe we could launch a contest.
We could launch a contest. But you're saying most words that are sort of made up like that just don't catch on.
No, it's very rare that you can make up a word, set it free in the world, and it will come back to you in somebody else's language.
It's just not the way language works?
Not often. I mean, there have been, you know, again, there have been other contests. I mean, my favorite was the Ever Ready Light Bulb Company. Mm-hmm. And this isn't like 1920s. They offered $3,000 as a reward to somebody who could come up with a better word for flashlight. I don't know what was wrong with flashlight at the time, but they wanted a better one. $3,000 was
a lot of money.
Huge amount of money. And what was interesting about that was four different people sent out the same word, and they all got the $3,000. Very happy, I'm sure. And the word was Dalo, and of course, it didn't catch on at all. Mm-hmm. And almost every contest you can look at, and there have been dozens of contests to create new words, they really never catch on.
You included a word that Thomas Jefferson made up, belittle.
Yes.
And then you also include a review, I guess it was the London Review, where they just really took him to task.
Right. They wrote
this word.
They wrote to Jefferson, "We will forgive all your attacks, impotent as they are illiberal upon our national character. For the future, spare, oh spare, we beseech you, our mother tongue." But as late as 1926, Henry Fowler, in his modern English usage, was still saying that belittle was an undesirable alien. So nobody really thinks twice about using belittle now. But
it's a good word, I think.
It's a fine word, yeah. And there's obviously a need for it.
You also say that the word balding, when it first appeared, was considered an offensive thing.
Yes. A lot of people
didn't like this word.
A lot of people did not like balding. The reason that they did not like balding was because it appeared to have been formed as a past participle of the verb to bald. And the language commentators who disliked it said, well, this is ridiculous. There is no such word, no verb to bald. Now, it turns out that they were actually wrong. Bald was in use as a verb in the 17th century for some short period of time, but at the time that balding came up in the early 20th century, to bald was not a verb. But people really hated it, and they would just say, balding is just not a word. And Theodore Bernstein, who wrote a lot of books on language and was the editor of the New York Times, he was always suggesting, he wrote about it in like two or three books. He kept coming back to it because he hated it so much. And he kept on trying to get people to use the word baldish.
Baldish.
Yeah, and he thought baldish made much more
like
sense.
Like a baldish head.
Right. In some ways, baldish does not. It does make sense because you are not, his view is that you're not watching somebody go bald. So therefore, balding doesn't make sense. But people seem to like balding, and we've taken it on, and Western civilization somehow marches on.
Have there been certain arbiters over the years? I mean, certain either individuals or books or dictionaries that seem to have defined what's a real word and what isn't?
Well, I don't know if you can say that anybody has defined what's a real word. I mean, certain works have had enormous influence. Johnson's dictionary in 1755 had a great deal of influence. But one of the things that's lovely about that is it did a huge amount to kind of standardize spelling and kind of codify the English language. And it also introduced a number of mistakes. Yeah. So, for instance, up until Johnson's dictionary, internecine meant widespread slaughter. And he mistakenly thought it meant mutual destruction. And so he just added that definition on his own, and now that's the only way
exactly.
that people use the word. So we can thank Johnson for that blunder.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about words in this hour of Radio Times. Our guest is Ammon Shea. He's the author of a new book called Bad English, and it's subtitled A History of Linguistic Aggravation. His previous book was called Reading the OED, the Oxford English Dictionary. We want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Westchester University has been offering graduate studies for over 50 years. Today, Westchester has over 70 graduate degree and certificate programs in business and public affairs, health, visual and performing arts, education, arts and sciences, and their new doctorate of nursing practice. With campuses in suburban Chester County, the new Center City, Philadelphia location, or online. Details at wcupa.edu/grad. Graduate education at Westchester University. Learn more.
This week on This American Life.
It seemed as if this time capsule hadn't been opened in 50 years.
Three boys break into an old abandoned house.
All their personal belongings were right there, so they felt so close.
You don't leave things like a wallet with money in it or your address book.
Something terrible had happened. Something catastrophic had happened to the people in the house.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Brad Meltzer is a best-selling thriller writer, but when he wanted to write about the biggest, most heroic adventures he could think of, he turned to children's literature.
To my daughter, Amelia Earhart isn't some black-and-white figure from a history book. Amelia Earhart is alive, and she's brave, and most important, she's fun.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, again talking with Amon Shea about his new book called Bad English, A History of Linguistic Aggravation. We posted something yesterday on our Facebook just asking people about words that bothered them. And we heard from use of the word over, where the speaker really means more. For example, there were over 300 people at the service versus there were more than 300 people. Someone says, I get really annoyed by people who get really annoyed by unimportant uses, misuses of words. Different than instead of different from, using less than when it should be fewer than. Someone said, I hate the phrase, let's lunch today. The idea of using, I guess, a noun as a verb. So a long list of complaints on our Facebook page. And we're talking again with Amon Shea about how words became words and people begin to use them and how their meanings have changed over time. 1-888-477-9499. On your previous book, the Reading the OED, you used the word stupider.
Yes.
And you had a lot of negative comments about your use of the word stupider.
Yes. I fallen into the habit of saying stupider out loud, unfortunately enough, on some radio interviews. A number of people wrote me letters saying that this made me sound, well, more stupid than I needed to. And it's one of the things that prompted me to write this book, because I will happily confess to complete ignorance on the subject. I really had no idea why stupider was considered to not be a word. It seems to me it's an adjective, and you want to make it comparative,
right.
You add an ER and then right. It works fine. And so I started looking into why is stupider not considered a word, and there's really no good answer to that. And if you want to look at it in kind of technical terms, the way the linguists would, it's called a disyllabic adjective, meaning two-syllable adjective, and it's formed with an alveolar stop, which means that you end the word by touching your tongue to the little ridge right behind your teeth, the alveolar ridge. There are plenty of other words in English, such as polite and solid, which are formed the same exact way. They're two-syllable adjectives with an alveolar stop. And I don't think anybody really gets that upset about politer or solider.
Right.
Yet, for some reason, we've stupider. Gotten this thing about stupider. I can understand you feeling it's ungainly, but saying that it's not a word, once again, I think is stretching it a little bit.
Well, one person wrote to you, I initially thought you were an interesting and intelligent man, but then I heard you use the word stupider and immediately realized that you're nothing but a fool, and I shall never again listen to anything you have to say on the subject of language.
I was paraphrasing that a little bit, but I received a lot of similar missives, I think.
But people are passionate about language.
They really are. And I applaud that kind of passion. I think it's really lovely that people are passionate about language. What I do not applaud, however, is the incessant need that many people seem to have to carp and to kind of belittle, to use our new favorite word,
yes, indeed,
belittle the language
thank you,
use Thomas of others.
Yeah.
One of the things that's really quite fascinating to me about English is it's not just that the words and the meanings change, but that the rules surrounding these words change as well. We've mentioned the word unique earlier. Unique is one of these words that people just love to grab onto and say, you know, this shall not stand, you know, this modification of unique. It's really viewed as a kind of crime against humanity to try to make, say, more unique or, you know, most unique. Right. And the reason behind this, as I'm sure most of your listeners who are sitting there gnashing their teeth in fury know, is that unique is what's referred to as an absolute adjective. These are adjectives that have no state of variation. It's kind of like saying the word is either pregnant or it's not pregnant. You know, something is unique or it is not unique. There is no varying degree here. But we have lots of things that we've thought of as absolute adjectives in the past. And seeing as we're sitting in a room that's right across from a Constitution Hall, the preamble to the Constitution of the United States, the first line has the phrase, in order to create a more perfect union. So since at least the 1700s, we've been modifying perfect, and lots of other people have modified perfect. And they used to make lists, some of the people who cared about language and wrote about it, used to make these wonderful lists of absolute adjectives. And at one point in time, dry, wet, straight, flat, clear, equal, correct, quiet, empty, true, full. Those are all considered to be absolute adjectives.
Huh.
And so it would be considered a crime against the English language by some people to modify those in any way. We seem to be pretty much okay with that now, but we've really held on to this prescription with unique.
I do want to get to our callers, but let me just throw the word ain't out there. Mm-hmm. You include that. It's included in dictionaries, and I'm sure for some people that is like fingernails on the blackboard.
It really is. And one of the things that brought ain't to the forefront was when it was included in Merriam-Webster's Third New International Dictionary in 1961, which some of your listeners may remember. And this was seen as Merriam-Webster giving the seal of approval to ain't. They'd actually been including it in dictionaries since 1890. Dictionaries, they don't approve or disapprove of language, they just catalog it. So they were saying that people use this word, and that is true. People do use the word. They may use it in a jocular fashion, they may use it jokingly, you know, say it ain't sojo, politics ain't beanbag, it don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing, but everybody pretty much uses the word. You can't say that jocular language use doesn't count. It does. And so a language, you know, guide or a reference work such as the dictionary will try to catalog that.
And a dictionary is not about necessarily correct. I mean, it's, I guess, the correct. Well, is it correct? Or is it just this is how people use words?
The trend in lexicography or in dictionary writing has generally been towards descriptivism, which is to describe the language as it is used. And it's not describing all of the language because that's impossible, but it's trying to describe the general social register that is commonly understood to be the English language.
We have an email from McShirley, or M. Shirley, or from Shirley. There we go. Somehow I learned that hilarious was the proper word to use, but I often hear folks using hysterical in its place. Any thoughts? I guess the interchanging of hysterical and hilarious.
Yeah, well, you know, hysterical has obviously taken on a kind of broadened meaning. It, you know, comes from
hysteria.
Right, hysteria. And so it's, I think that it's got two meanings. And people use it to mean hilarious. Mm-hmm. And you could say that this is improper. Or you could also say that people generally will understand, given the context in which you're talking, whether you mean that somebody is actually hysterical and is running around pulling their hair out, or if they're simply funny.
And that's Ammon Shea, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He loves language. He's written several books, Reading the OED, One Man, One Year, 21,730 pages, along with Depraved English, Insulting English, and The Phone Book. And his new book we're talking about called Bad English, A History of Linguistic Aggravation. Calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Grady from Westchester to join us on Radio Times. Grady, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, hello. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
And your show is a delicious delight today.
Well,
I have
it.
A word to offer that I didn't invent myself, but I heard it, and I thought, this is an obvious word. This word defines a particular weather condition where it's a slightly rainy, dreary day. The word is drizzle.
Yeah.
D-R-I-Z-N-A-L. Does that word exist?
It exists if you use it enough.
It exists now, Grady.
Because I get it. Yeah. Well, I just wanted to thank you for this show. It's extremely pleasant.
Well, that's great.
And I would hope that people do not use the quantitative lesser and fewer to define the volumetric greater and lesser. Thank you for taking my call.
All right, your pet peeve there, Grady. Lesser, fewer. How do we? Where do we come down on this?
I am relatively agnostic on it, but I understand the distinction that people make.
Right. How about that and which?
That and which? Do you really want to go into that on air?
I don't know. Do I?
It kind of necessitates.
I could use some help.
Necessitates a discussion of relative non-restrictive or clauses.
Nah.
It's
like don't worry about it.
Yeah,
that or which? Okay, very good. Let me get Townsend from looks like Riverton, New Jersey. Townsend, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi there.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Great program, as
Thanks.
Always.
Thanks.
Approaching 7 years old, as a child in elementary school, I carried a dictionary in my pocket, word read. Phrase that is increasingly broadspread in even formal journalism which is and exposes imprecise information in the speaker, one of the only, where only is either an exclusive, unique individual, and one of would be really one of a few, or I don't really know, this would be the speaker, how many of these there are out there, but there don't seem to be many of them. It's a pet peeve, that phrase, one of the only.
One of the only, and I'm sure, Townsend, I have used that on the air more than once. Let me see what Ammon Shea has to say.
I don't have any words of wisdom or even words of hope for you, I'm sorry to say. One thing I would point out is that by the time you are annoyed enough with a usage that you are noticing it, it's probably too late to do anything about it. You know, we generally don't complain about language use that is so sporadic that it's dying out. We complain about things that are on the upswing. I applaud your sentiment of wanting to make a clear distinction. I think it's absolutely fine. I would caution against any hopes that journalists or other speakers of the English language are going to change.
Well said, Ed Townsend. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. And does it matter? I mean, I know you're not a rule person, but is it different if people are writing versus people are talking?
No, absolutely.
If you're talking spontaneously,
sure.
You're gonna step all over yourself.
Absolutely.
As I often
and,
do.
Yeah, sure. Colloquial language is far different. It's really very different from written language. But we also we see different registers in written language. For instance, people frequently like to complain about the language use of youth.
Right.
It's always a favorite target. These darn kids ruining, stepping all over our language. By and large, kids are anybody. They know the difference between texting and writing a school report. And there's this notion that things are really going downhill. To me, that's this kind of fallacy that I like to say. It's kind of the things were so much better before universal education caught on. You know, I mean, I think that we're not worse users of language now than we were 500 years ago. For one thing, the literacy rate is far higher.
Sure.
It is... a lot of the things that we love to be annoyed by are, in fact, quite a bit older than we think. So, speaking of text speak, one of my favorites is the OMG, which
yeah,
everybody loves to hate OMG. And the Oxford English Dictionary created a little tempest in a teacup the other year when they included OMG in the dictionary. And what was interesting about it was it's a historical dictionary, so they give the earliest use that they have of the word, and the earliest use of OMG was from 1917, and it was John Arbuthnot Fisher, who at the time was the admiral of the British Navy, writing a letter to, as I say, another famously vapid teenager, Winston Churchill. So this was not OMG in the sense of, you know, two teenage girls texting each other in school. These were two of the most powerful politicians in the history of the British Empire engaging in official correspondence. So OMG is not a particularly recent innovation, and most of the abbreviations that come up in text speak and things like that are not really that new. LOL is pretty new.
Well, it'd be interesting if he had written LOL
right,
in 1917.
He didn't. But he spelled out very clear. He wrote OMG and then parentheses. He wrote,
oh my God.
Oh my God. Wow. So it was very clear what he was saying.
You include, and then we'll get back to our callers, you include a time when Teddy Roosevelt, President Teddy Roosevelt, this is back in the early 20th century, wanted to, change some of some words and how certain words were spelled.
Yeah, and he issued an edict, so to speak. He instructed the government printing office to change the spelling of 300 words, just because he didn't like the way they were spelled. You know, he was interested in simplified spelling, which was much more popular as a concept back then than it is now. And he was really widely ridiculed in both the press, and Congress overturned the edict a few months mm-hmm. later, and nothing really ever came of it.
Well, he wanted to change the word kissed, for instance, K-I-S-S-E-D to K-I-S-T.
Right. That was seen as a little more commonsensical spelling.
Well, he wasn't the king. You know, he was the president. You don't get to do that, apparently. Let me get Tom from Princeton, New Jersey, to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Tom. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning, Marty. Good morning, Mr. Shea. Good
morning.
Just a question about prescriptivist versus descriptivist schools of grammar. Mr. Shea, you sound more like you're on the descriptivist side. Is that correct?
That is indeed
guilty
correct.
Guilty as charged,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
And I guess my question would be, what role does prescriptivism play in our society, if any?
I think there is nothing wrong with rules per se in language, and there's nothing wrong with having kind of a common sense approach to what is correct in language. That being said, I guess what I'm against are kind of the nonsensical rules. I think it's fine to say this is more eloquent or this is a better use of word. This gives you more clarity of meaning. I'm in favor of subject-verb agreement, things along those lines. And I think that's paying attention to words and paying attention to language is a lovely thing. What I find problematic is when people say things along the lines of, enormity. People love to complain about enormity and say, well, enormity should not mean something large. It should only mean some great wickedness. Barack Obama was scolded roundly for this use a few years ago. And a number of people said, well, instead of saying enormity, he should have said enormousness. He was talking about the enormity of the task facing us. And they all said, well, he should have said the enormousness of the task. Except the problem with that is that for the first 200 years that it existed in English, enormousness meant great wickedness.
Oh.
And enormous, when it first came into the language, meant it referred to something abnormal or wicked. And these words later on took on the meaning of something large. So it's somewhat irrational to me that we will allow words like enormousness to change, but we will not allow enormity to change. I think it makes sense to say this is a word that will upset many users if you use it in this sense, but I don't think it makes sense to simply say, therefore, it does not mean this.
I mean, do you want we don't want warning labels before we say the words the word enormity, do we?
No, I don't think so.
We're almost up in a break here, but you talk about the root of the word fun.
Uh-huh.
You know, fun, funner, funnest.
Right.
Can you do that quickly?
Fun was frowned upon as an adjective because supposedly fun was nothing but a noun. It kind of crept into the language first as a verb and then as a noun. And so you should not say something is fun, because it's like saying something is enjoyment.
It's a noun, right?
Right. And then in 1846, we saw it used in as an attributive adjective, which is a noun functioning as an adjective. It was used in the phrase a fun room, kind of like a college student, where college is modifying student. And once it did that, then it kind of segued effortlessly into becoming an adjective. And so we can see the roots of this word moving in that it still feels uncomfortable for us to use funner and funnest.
Let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation with our guest, Emin Shea. He has a new book called Bad English, A History of Linguistic Aggravation. We have almost the full bank of calls here at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. More after this short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Amtrak, featuring patripsbytrain.com, offering train packages to destinations along Amtrak's Keystone service line. More information on available excursion packages at patripsbytrain.com.
I've got the key to the highway.
Brothers Phil and Dave Alvin, formerly of the Blasters, have recorded their first album together in about 30 years. It features songs by bluesman Big Bill Brunzi. On the next Fresh Air, the Alvins perform in our studio, tell us how they first discovered the blues, and we talk about Phil's recent near-death experience. Join us.
This afternoon at 3, and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
How the small world of a conflicted dentist becomes the universal search for truth.
He's at great odds with the city. He's sort of raised both fists at the universe.
The story of Job for our time, Joshua Ferris's To Rise Again at a Decent Hour, our first book club discussion on faith, humor, and our journey to know who we are. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
today at noon on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, the Lincoln Motor Company, introducing the first ever Lincoln MKC with available active noise control that reduces unwanted cabin noise to help provide a more pleasant driving experience. More at Lincoln.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, again talking with Ammon Shea about words and his book called Bad English. And I do want to get to our callers, but first we want to do a little reading that's included in this book. This is Hamlet, Act 3, Scene 1. Maybe you should set it up for our listeners just so they know what the heck we're doing here.
Okay, well, I took a little slice of Shakespeare and kind of copy-edited it. Applying some of the rules that have been used in English usage over the past several hundred years, and seeing how Shakespeare might have been corrected. So, shall I just start reading?
You be the Shakespeare, okay. I'll be the correction.
To be or not to be, that is the question.
This is a statement, not a question.
Whether 'tis.
Avoid contractions.
Nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous.
This word is of French origin. Can you find one from Anglo-Saxon roots?
Fortune.
See previous comment. Perhaps use Old English hap instead of Latinate fortune.
Or to take arms against a sea of troubles.
Avoid metaphors that you are used to seeing in print.
And by opposing, end them. To die, to sleep no more. And by a sleep, to say we end. The heartache and the thousand natural shocks that flesh is heir to.
Do not end sentences with prepositions.
Tis.
Avoid contractions.
A consummation.
Author appears to be the first one to use this word in this sense. Is this a mistake?
Devoutly to be wished. To die, to sleep, perchance, to dream. Aye, there's the rub.
Author is first to use this expression. What does there's the rub mean? Very good. Right. The point is that Shakespeare... I mean, not only did he broke rules, but he made up rules,
right.
too.
Yeah, he was astonishingly playful with his language. And, you know, one of the things that I think is lovely about Shakespeare is that he invents so many words. And he's lauded as being this prolific inventor of words. And it turns out he didn't really invent nearly as many words as we think he did. He was previously credited with thousands of words. It's more likely in the hundreds. Mm-hmm. But in subsequent to writing this book, I have... did some research on Shakespeare's word coining, and something I found is that about 20% of the words that we think of as having been invented by him were actually just what we would call functional shift, which is that he was the first person to use a word as a verb that already existed as a noun. So he was the first person to use pellet or drug or scissor as a verb, even though these words already existed. Mm-hmm. And he's credited now as being the inventor of that. So I think it's odd that we applaud him for this, yet we then tell students that impact is not a verb and contact, don't use contact as a verb, it's a noun. So we make allowances for Shakespeare that we don't allow ourselves.
Mm. Maybe because he's Shakespeare.
Oh, that's true.
Let me get Mary from Williamstown, New Jersey to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Mary, go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
This is an interesting program.
Good.
And I've been bothered by some certain words, particularly one that's used by the weather forecasters. When they say seasonable weather, and all of them say it, it cringes me because I think it should be seasonal weather. Am I wrong in that assumption?
Well, you might not have called the right show if you want to find out whether you were right or wrong, Mary, but let me give Ammon Shea a chance to respond.
I'm sorry, I do not have a strong feeling on seasonable one way or the other.
And it's interesting how, I guess, certain occupations end up using certain kinds of words.
Right, there is jargon that will creep in. For instance, people used to complain about broadcasted being used because broadcast was seen as the past tense of broadcast, you know, it cast something. You don't say we casted something off. You say we cast. Therefore, broadcast should not turn into broadcasted. People have been complaining about people on air, journalists speaking on air for considerable length of time, and people also complained quite a bit about using the word air as a verb, as in the show aired earlier today.
Interesting.
So you're in a long line of noble complaints there, I can tell you that.
Mary, thanks for the call. Let's see what Diane from South Philadelphia has to say. Diane, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, good morning. The thing that really bothers me, the phrase gone missing.
It used to be the cat is missing, and now all of a sudden the cat is gone missing, and it's redundant, and it just gets under my skin.
Gone missing. I mean, I guess it adds a little drama, perhaps, Hammond?
I don't know whether it adds drama. It certainly adds drama to your life if you find yourself annoyed by it. So that's something. And you know, I don't know the answer to why people say it. I'm sorry.
Okay, fair enough. Diane, but you can hold on to that. Hold on to that anger. You do include an ad, and I'm old enough to remember the ad. It was for a cigarette. Winston.
Yes.
Winston tastes good like a cigarette should.
Sure. That came up in the mid-1950s, and it was really a big to-do. There was a famous incident where Walter Cronkite was given a script to read on air with Winston tastes good like a cigarette should, and he refused to read it. He instead editorialized, and he changed it to Winston tastes good as a cigarette should. But plenty of other places did run the ad, and millions of people were outraged. And it was because like was being used, for those of your listeners who are under 50.
Yeah.
It was because the word like was being used as a conjunction, and it should not be used as a conjunction. You should use the word as. And that has largely faded from the view, our view of language. Most people do not worry about like. Now we worry about some other use of like, which is as the kids.
Oh, like.
Like it's a problem. It's now viewed as a meaningless word. And that's not true. Like does have many meanings and many functions. And some linguists have kind of looked into this, and they found that, I have to admit, like used to bother me. And then I, you know, read some linguistic papers on the functions that like has in a sentence, and it does very definite things. It functions as what they call a quotative compartmentalizer.
Meaning?
Well, that's indicating that a quote is about to follow. I was like, don't talk like that. So like is serving to set the stage for a quote that's soon to follow, or an approximative adverb, which indicates that some approximation of quantity or distance is going to come. Like that book has to be like 200 pages long as a discourse marker, which is at the beginning of a sentence, like that teacher's totally going to fail me. And or as a discourse particle, meaning that something that comes next is of note. And I like totally failed that test. You may not enjoy this, but it is serving a purpose. It's serving a very definite grammatical function. It may be one that you disapprove of, but it is not a meaningless word. The thing I find particularly lovely about like is that 100 years ago, people had very similar complaints to the use of the word well. And Ambrose Bierce, who famously wrote The Devil's Dictionary and also wrote on language, called this a mere meaningless prelude to a sentence. The difference between like and well is that your grandparents say well and your grandchildren say like. But in many cases, these two words are serving the same function. But well has gotten smoothed around the edges over the past 100 years.
So in 100 years, like will be just fine.
Right.
Spoken by the old people.
Right.
How about you know? I mean, that also has played an interesting role in language. And I sometimes think it's a way of connecting one person to the other. You know?
I think so. It's similar to like. One of the things that was also interesting about like was some people who studied it found that people who use like we're young people who use like we're viewed as less educated, but it's more likable when they use this in speech. And I think you know can serve a similar function. But as we were talking about before, people I think can shift between registers and will infrequently use you know in writing. It's a speech pattern.
Yeah. Let me get Monty from Long Beach Island to join us on Radio Times. I go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi there.
I feel I must put out from the get-go. I'm actually originally from Cincinnati.
Okay.
I love NPR and listen to it coast to coast now.
Good for you.
There's two points I would like to get your guest opinion of. Number one, what are his feelings on Dr. Seuss and his use of the language? And number two, what are the basic Germanic connections to English and German, because I'm Jewish and know Yiddish, and I feel like a lot of English incorporates that, you know, prefixes, suffixes. You
sure.
can tack things onto the beginning or end of words, and you know, it doesn't change the meaning, but it definitely alters it.
Well, Monty, I appreciate the call to Radio
sure.
Times.
Well, first
you,
of
have
all,
a, you, I, have, you have a 4-year-old, so
yes,
do you like Dr. Seuss?
I am, of course, a fan of Dr. Seuss. I believe he did coin the word nerd. It's one of the rare words that people can kind of coin and put out there. The question about the Germanic significance of English is a great question. English is a Germanic language, and it is Germanic in structure. It comes from the Germanic language family. It is not a Romance language, which is why we've had so many problems with people trying to put a Latinate word structure onto English. This is why it has been ineffectual to say you cannot end your sentence with a preposition or you should not split infinitives because Latin doesn't do that. We're not Latin, and we don't come from Latin. Germanic languages tend to have prepositions at the end of their sentences, and it's no trouble at all. So it has changed significantly, obviously. And, you know, English comes from Middle English, which comes from Old English. And Old English was quite a bit different in that it was a heavily case-inflected language. And we didn't have a, it was, there were a lot more endings to designate what part a word played. And so that's given us a lot of our structure.
But there was the Roman invasion. I mean, it's not
right.
like
sure.
Latin
well,
didn't have an
no,
influence.
No, about 70 or 80% of our vocabulary is from a Latin-based origin. And because right. It was the Roman invasion in about 550 BC, and then there was the Norman invasion, which brought all these Latinate words via the French, and then the Industrial Revolution. So even though an enormous portion of our vocabulary is Romance, it's still not a Romance language, and this is evident in the fact that you can easily create a sentence that has no Latin root words in it, but you cannot create any sentences in English that do not have a Germanic root.
Interesting. Monty, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And Yiddish, I mean, to me, Yiddish is just the most alive and wonderful language where every word really sounds like what it means.
Sure.
It's absolutely fabulous. The United States does not have an official language. England does.
It is.
Or
English, yes.
Yes,
yeah,
English.
Yeah.
France, I guess. France is.
I believe it is official, and they also have the Académie Française,
yes.
which is the sort of regulatory body of the French language, which I don't think that many people pay attention to. their strictures. But no, we do not have an official language in America. In the United States.
Let me get to it. Looks like Claire from Bucks County to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Claire. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I'm enjoying this conversation that you and your guest are having tremendously.
Good.
I have two things to ask. One, advertisers use all the time, I just passed a billboard for one of the fast foods that says Relationship, S-I-P, for their beverage. They make up words all the time.
Sure.
I find that quite annoying. And the other thing is, what does your guest feel about the word supercalifragilisticexpialidocious?
What do you think about that word, Emma?
I don't have strong feelings about the supercalifragilisticexpialidocious
right.
one way or another, though it's an interesting word. I don't believe it's the longest word in the dictionary, though that's sometimes said of it. I think it's a fine word, but I can't say I've ever used it tremendously myself. Again, people have also been complaining about advertisers and their apparent misuse of language for well over 100 years now. But if the word doesn't have a use, or if it doesn't fall in, you know, if people don't have a use for it, it won't stick. But I don't think we can place too much blame on them. They're trying things out all the time, but they're not really the ones who are responsible for the language. We are as a people.
It's interesting, and I wonder whether this has been true for you, which is most of our callers have, you know, called to complain about things they don't like about
sure,
the English language,
yes.
and they want you to set them straight. And you really have a very different view of how words evolve and what languages, where they come from,
right.
and their liveliness.
Sure, I think anything worth fighting about is worth celebrating. And I think that, again, the thing that's so vibrant about the English language is the fact that it's changing. And if we ever were able to make it set in stone, all that it would mean is that our language is dead.
Wow.
And I understand this feeling that if a word is somehow special or has a real specificity of meaning, that you want to preserve that. And I understand saying, well, I don't like the way that word sounds. But if you go back and you look at all the words that have been frowned upon over the years, you very quickly realize that what is considered correct 50, 100 years ago is really quite alien to us today. I mean, the notion that zoom, for instance, has to imply upward mobility because it's an aviation term. The fact that dilapidated was supposed to only refer to a house that was made out of stone. I don't think we observe this kind of distinction. And if you were to go back and try to observe all the distinctions and forms of specific meaning, you would find yourself quite unable to speak.
We are almost out of time here, but it's so interesting. I mean, you really have spent so much of your life with words and language, reading the Oxford English Dictionary. What intrigues you so much?
I had previously been a furniture mover, and believe it or not, it's a very logical progression to go from furniture mover to writing about dictionaries, because there are few occupations that are more onerous or arduous than carrying pianos upstairs.
I can't imagine.
So it's really a much more pleasant way to spend one's time. But I'm fascinated by language. I think it's a lovely thing to kind of roll around in, to cherish language. And I find it more engaging to celebrate than to chastise or objurgate.
Objurgate, that's a big word. Evan Shea, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. And again, his book is called Bad English, and it's subtitled A History of Linguistic Aggravation. And he's also the author of a book called Reading the OED, One Man, One Year, 21,730 pages. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. In fact, you can continue the conversation we started yesterday on our Facebook page about words. Bob Alls, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant with Sophie Reed. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.